Hello, and welcome to Into the Aether. It's a low-key video game podcast, and I'm Brendan Bigley.
I'm Stephen Hilger. You're excited.
Yeah, I am excited. You know why, Stephen? Do you know why I'm excited?
I sort of know. Tell me.
I think, okay, so there's two reasons. One that you sort of know, and one that I have been talking about for, I feel like, 3 months, which is that now that we've done the Dragon's Dogma 2 episode, I feel like we're in, like, a free, like, open plane. We can do anything now. I feel the freedom of movement. I can swing my arms out and know that I'm not going to hit anything, which is a really nice feeling.
I had an instinct to pull a Xenosaga, as I say, and I'm like, what is the weirdest game I can counterpunch our string of recent releases with?
You know? It turns out that April is actually January, so January games afoot here in April.
You're onto something. Aries is the first sign of the zodiac, so there is a
is that
beginning.
True?
Yeah,
I didn't know that.
There's a beginning to the spring season that is not representative of Q1. January is corporate beginning of the year. We're actually in the solstice, baby.
Wow. So you're saying that the zodiac does not align with corporate interests?
Thankfully not. Although I did see there's a Sanctuary World is like a astrology Instagram account that I follow, and they'll just do stuff like, here's like a text you'd receive from Aries. It's kind of silly. But I saw recently they posted like a crossover with Taco Bell, and they're like, here's every Taco Bell item that the signs would be. And I'm like, this feels like a stretch. And also, Taco Bell is investing in astrology?
That tracks for me.
I think Taco Bell and Arby's are weirdly like the two fast food chains that are trying to be a little bit more like alternative in their marketing.
Yeah.
I think they know what the like reputation of their places are, and they're kind of leaning into being like almost Dada with their marketing.
Yeah, that I'm cool with. I'm less cool with like the Wendy's vibe, which Wendy's is like, we're going to be chaos. Like, we're going to be like agents of anarchy via our social media presence. And I'm like, nobody thinks of Wendy's that way. Like, no, like I think of Wendy's as like somehow more buttoned up than McDonald's Corp in a lot of ways. And yet their social media presence is like all lowercase all the time, always screaming about everything. And I don't buy it.
I had no idea. I've often said Wendy's is like my favorite of that like classic fast food definition. Wendy's is the one that I go to the most. But now I'm questioning that given their social media presence.
It's really interesting because it's like, as somebody who has worked in social media marketing for a very long time, whenever you go to like social media marketing conferences, which I've been to, and you like go and sit in those presentations.
Sorry, that sounded so real. I was going to ask if you were okay. the quick bleh was like a little too realistic. Anyway, continue.
When I sit in those presentations, Wendy's always comes up as like, Wendy's is the forefather of fucking getting it. Like, they know how to talk to millennials. At least that's what they were saying in like the early 2010s, at least. And I think that Wendy's going in that direction has poisoned social media marketing so much that every brand is now a person with a personality, which I don't want from my social media experience. I like when I get a response from Swiffer when I'm like posting about Dragon's Dogma, I'm like, don't fucking talk to me, Swiffer.
I think I like really deeply spiritually disconnected from all social media the minute I saw TD Bank tweet, I can has cheeseburger or something. Like, years after anyone on earth would say that without, you know, getting shoved into a locker.
You know, it's been in approvals for that long, too.
Yeah.
Like, some poor social media marketing agent was like, I want to tweet I can has cheeseburger. And they said that in 2007 when Twitter launched. And then that got sent to brand, and then brand sent it to legal, and then legal sent it back to brand. And then it turns out they needed to send it to like, because TD Bank is a Canadian bank that also operates in the US. So they needed to send it to corporate back in Canada, and then Canada had to approve it in both places, and then they had to send it back. By the time you get there, that social media person has now become the CEO, and they just approved it, but it's 2024 and it's too late for that.
Yeah. Now, to be clear, I don't know what the answer is. I don't know how to come off as a cool bank account, but I feel like it's gone so in that direction.
I don't think they should. That's my
thing. That's the thing. Yes. Yeah. I would actually think it was cooler just to be like, do you need advice to say to stay tax solvent? And like, that's it. And just like a stock photo of a guy in khakis, like eating fruit salad.
What if you were just helpful?
That is more irreverent than like, who's ready to get wacky on Tuesday? And like a gif of some sitcom from 2009.
Yeah. like linking to you're the man now dog.com.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, maybe that I would like. That's like old enough that I'm like someone gets it. But like the like a Parks and Rec gif with like who's mm-hmm. wacky? It's like, come on.
Yeah.
Anyway, so you're excited because of the new era, the bankless social media has become fake accounts talking to each other. We are now free, greener pastures, spring, first sign of the zodiac. What's the other reason you're excited?
Yeah, the other reason I'm excited is I received a very generous gift recently from someone who I will keep nameless, but you know who you are. Thank you so much. I received the gift of a Playdate, which is a device by Panic.
I love the look of it.
It looks amazing. It's if you haven't seen the Playdate, first of all, go to play.date and just like look at it because it's amazing. But it's essentially a little yellow square with a screen on it and a D-pad, a B button, an A button. And then on the side, there's a little I'm gonna show you this and you're gonna be able to hear this, dear listener. But when you pull this device out, it makes a little great noise. And that noise signifies that you've opened up and pulled out the crank. There's a crank on the side of the device, which you can, you know, crank forwards or crank backwards. And essentially what they've done is created a little device and handed it to a bunch of great indie developers and said, please just make games for this. And when people sell them, we will deliver them to their devices. It has a pretty small rectangular black and white screen with no backlight. So it's like reminiscent of the Game Boy, but with like a much, much, much higher pixel density. So you're still getting like blocky pixel art on it, but it's all in black and white. And at least when it came out, so it got announced 2 years ago, it like fully came, like people started really receiving them like in mass about a year ago. And what they did, what I think was really novel. So they, like I said, reached out to a bunch of indie developers and said like, hey, please make some games for this. This is like a novel device, right? D-pad, two buttons, and this crank on the side. Like, what do you want to make with this? And if you bought a Playdate, you get what is called season one of the Playdate library. And what that means is that from the moment you turn on the Playdate for the first time, like link your account with the website and whatever, every week they will send you two games from that season of the Playdate library. So right now, at least as of this recording, I only have two of those games on my Playdate device, both of which are great. But I know that next, I guess, Wednesday or Thursday, I'm going to get two more, and I'm going to get two more after that and after that. And there's like a reason to be booting up this device at least once a week and checking it out, which I think is great by itself. Like, I think on the whole, that is a very cool thing. They have since moved away from the season idea, but if you buy a Playdate, you still get that first season of games delivered in that way. And it starts whenever you get the Playdate. Because when I received it and turned it on, I just expected to get the whole first season of games because I thought it was like, oh, they're all out, so I can just go play them all. But no, it's an individualized experience that you have when you get the Playdate, which I think is very cool. The other thing that they've started doing recently, as of like a couple months ago, is they now have like a game catalog, which is essentially just like an app store that you can open up on the Playdate. You can also buy stuff from their website, but it's just a bunch of games that, you know, people have made for the Playdate, and you can just buy them individually. And they're all like really cheap. They're like $1 or $2. Like the most expensive one I bought so far is $10, and that's like few and far between. Usually they're like well under $10. And that by itself is a very cool system because there are just like some games that are kind of like bigger experiences or things that are not included in like the season or whatever. And then alongside that, this is a thing I didn't even know until I bought the thing, because I knew that people were like making Game Boy emulators and stuff for this. But what I didn't realize is that there was a whole industry of people making games for this and then uploading them to itch.io. And you can download the game from itch. And then when you go to your account page on the Panic website, there's like a little drag and drop section, and you can just drag the game file into it, and it just uploads it to your Playdate from there. So you're essentially like sideloading indie games from itch onto the Playdate as well. And when you when it gets delivered to the Playdate, there's like a little notification light on the top that kind of turns on depending on like when you've gotten games, and they show up. Honestly, it reminds me a lot of the 3DS. It has that like fun energy of the 3DS, where every game that shows up is like a little box that needs to be unwrapped. So like when you hit A on a new game that's there, there's like a little kind of ribbon and some like claw hands come out and then like open it up and it reveals the game that you have.
I love that.
And that idea essentially has like just seeped its way into every single bit of this device. Like, they made the thing to be fun and irreverent and weird and experimental in, like, every facet, from, like, the UI to obviously the way every game works to even, you know, this model of how they're selling and delivering games to you and allowing you to, you know, sideload games. It's all one complete package that I think is really special. I had never really intended on getting a Playdate, if I'm being honest. Like, I always thought it was like a cool, interesting, novel device, but at $200, it's $200. At $200, I thought it was a little bit much for me. It seemed like the kind of thing I would maybe get eventually used from somebody else and then check it out. But the thing that I was most interested in eventually checking out was, like, I know that there's a Playdate emulator on the Steam Deck, so you can, like, get this thing that essentially turns your Steam Deck into a Playdate, and I think instead of the crank, you use the right analog stick and you, like, rotate it forwards or backwards. But again, you can just buy all these games off of Itch and they just come as zip files and you can upload them to your Steam Deck and then you can play them that way if you want to. So, like, that was the thing that I was planning on doing eventually, is like doing an episode like this where I was just going to, like, use the Steam Deck as a Playdate and then see if I wanted to actually get a Playdate based off of that experience. But again, very generously, I was gifted one. And Steven, it's amazing. It's like, I feel like it is everything that you and I talk about on this show boiled down into one device. Like, it feels like every avenue of different conversations that we've had for the past 5-6 years all kind of culminating in this little weird yellow rectangle. It's stuff like, you know, even recently we talked about the Switch only having two themes on it, and, like, you know, the Switch has kind of, like, lost the fun and the magic of other Nintendo devices like the 3DS, which I just shouted out. Like, that's the thing that we've talked about a lot. That is all part and parcel with the Playdate experience. There's stuff like our Nintendo DS bonus, where we played all of those Nintendo DS games and did, like, a retrospective of the console. The first, like, hour of that conversation is talking about how special that hardware is and how much delivering to developers this weird device that has two screens and the bottom one is a touchscreen challenged a lot of development teams to come up with, like, unique and interesting devices or and interesting experiences on there. And over the course of time, people started to kind of glom onto that, like, an audience way outside of what we consider to be, like, the standard video game audience started picking up the DS, and it almost became the best-selling console of all time. And I think experiencing all of those DS games in a row in, like, a pretty short period of time made me kind of yearn for that again, like, made me yearn to be inspired by what games can be when they're not just locked to, like, D-pad, two analog sticks, four face buttons, and four shoulder buttons. Like, that has become the standard even on the Nintendo Switch at this point. Like, it does have a touchscreen. Some games are using it, but most are not. Most games are just using, you know, the standard control scheme that we have on the Xbox and the PlayStation and now the Switch as well. Even the Steam Deck, you know, like, for the most part, is trying to funnel you into that experience. Thankfully, they have the touchpads, which does make things interesting. But even still, with the Steam Deck, people are not making games for the Steam Deck, right? Like, right. People are making games for PC. And however you want to play it is how you can play it. But, like, the only game that I've played that's for the Steam Deck is that one that came with it, which is, like,
oh, yeah, the Aperture Desk Job Simulator, exactly. Or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah. And what a cool little, like, I think it's more than a tech demo, but it, you know, it sure is as short as one. But, like, what a cool experience that was to feel, yeah, to feel and experience this thing that made use of every single piece of technology inside the Steam Deck.
Or even Astro's Playroom, which we talk about a lot, where it's ironic, yeah, given that I think the PS5 is representative of a lot of the things you're critiquing here. But in that game, it doesn't feel that way. In right. that game, it feels like, oh, this is a system that is designed around these features of the controller. Whoops, that never happened.
Yeah.
You know, like, I mean, not to make light of the few games that do use that. And to be fair, I never expected for a PlayStation console for, like, there to be that conformity in design, mm-hmm, just because they're so third party centric. But yeah, it's tricky because on one hand, like, the DS, the Wii, and the Wii U are all consoles that had sort of a gimmick or some type of hardware design that if you were making a game for that console, you couldn't just ignore it. And if you did ignore it, the game suffered for it.
Yes.
So, like, if you just threw in motion controls after the fact for the Wii, no one's going to buy that version. They're going to buy the version on GameCube and Xbox.
Right.
But with the DS, I think it was really magical to see, like, I mean, how fun was it to hold the DS vertically and use it as, like, a notebook?
Yeah.
Or to see Bowser get so big, he takes up both screens.
Yeah, right.
Or, I mean, weirdly enough, Atlas was, like, the third party developer that was like, we are down for the DS. We're going to give you like a hospital simulator game. We're going to give you like Etrian Odyssey, which is based around writing and drawing maps. Like,
yeah,
something about the DS really inspired a lot of really cool design from Atlas, of all people.
Yeah.
Which like, not that that's surprising they were excited about it, but just like, I think when you think of companies like Atlas or Capcom or Namco, I don't always think like, oh, they're down to design around weird hardware. Mm-hmm. They make games that are sort of made for the usual format. And I think what I'm curious about is like, as we are at this ambiguous, surreal end to the current generation of consoles somehow, you know, we have PS5 saying it's halfway through its lifespan.
Right. The PS5 Pro like might be coming out this year. Same thing with a new updated version of the Series X.
Yeah, Xbox has made it clear that their strategy is like different, but also even leaning more into like, you can play these games anywhere. So there is no intended hardware at all. It's
yeah,
just like right. Wherever you can make it. And then the Switch 2, we kind of are only like musing about. So I think it does seem like games are headed towards a singularity in hardware, which on one hand, I think is good because that means that like it's easier for developers to make things for all consoles. And also we could potentially move away from exclusivity, which ultimately I think is a net positive just for like consumers. But in terms of exciting game design, there is a lot lost when you're not being challenged by limitation.
Yeah.
So I'm hoping that like, at least in the indie scene, which even just saying the indie scene is like multi-million dollar businesses, you know, there's right. a lot there. I wonder if we're going to see more and more hardware become indie and more stuff like the Playdate where it's like,
yes,
here's like a game jam manifested into a console.
Yes.
Essentially.
Yeah, that is, I think, the crux of what is going on with the Playdate that I find so interesting and so special is like, not only yeah. has Panic managed to make this device and, you know, literally just the addition, I mean, for all intents and purposes, it's a Game Boy Pocket with a crank on it, right? Like that is the crux of what's going on here. It does have some like more modern features. It has, you know, USB-C fast charging specifically, so it charges like immediately. It has Wi-Fi, so you can download stuff off the internet. If you're playing like arcade kind of games, your scores get uploaded to like a global leaderboard that you can see on the Panic website. Like there's a bunch of cool modern stuff going on, but at the end of the day, it is what if you put a crank on a Game Boy? And it turns out the answer to that question is people take heed of those limitations and they make really special experiences out of them. I think the most shocking thing about the Playdate experience for me so far has been how quickly developers have leapfrogged the like making little tech demos and like showing off how fun it is to have a crank on this thing and have just landed on like fully considered, thought out, great games that can only exist on this device, which is like the dream. I imagine if you're Panic, you know, and you're making this device is like, you don't even know what people are going to come up with. It's like when they added the App Store to the iPhone, you know, 2 years after the thing came out. Like, I'm sure Steve Jobs didn't envision some of the stuff that we'd be doing on our iPhone these days. I think similarly, when you just say, hey, we're reaching out to these developers who we know are like great at making indie games already, but we're also providing a really pretty easy to use like SDK and development toolkit, and anyone can make a game for this and upload it to itch, and any player who wants to play any of those games can very easily through our own website sideload stuff onto their own device. You just end up with so much weird stuff, because like even outside of playing games, people have figured out amazing things you can do with this device. Like I saw one app that I have not downloaded but I kind of want to because it seems so silly, which is literally an MP3 player. Like you could just get an MP3 player on the Playdate, sideload music onto it, and then just walk around and use it like an iPod if you want to. I saw somebody else who, because it's, you know, it's not an E-ink screen really, but like it's like a pretty, you know, it's a monochromatic LCD screen that doesn't have a backlight, so the battery life lasts forever on this thing. I saw somebody made an ebook reader for it, and you can read a book by like cranking through the pages of the book you're reading, which is amazing. Like people have really, even outside of the realm of games, like thought through all of the things they would want to do with this device. And I think that that's really special. Even outside of that, I think one of the things that really strikes me about the Playdate and a lot of the games that I played, I'm going to talk about a bunch of them, obviously, but like a lot of the games that I've played, I think have echoes of a thing that you and I have also talked about a lot, which especially on the DS episode, but even in like that one episode where I brought a bunch of PSP games, and just generally speaking, when you and I talk about handhelds in general, this idea that sometimes developers will kind of have this aha brain blast and say like, maybe you shouldn't be sitting here playing a handheld for 4 hours straight. Like maybe the appeal of a handheld in some ways is that its portability means you only need to be playing for like 10 minutes or 5 minutes or 1 minute or like 30 minutes at most. And there's kind of a joy in creating experiences based around those time constraints also.
Right. Sort of like the mission structure of Crisis Core on PSP.
Or Kingdom Hearts 358 over 2 days, that Roxas one, very similar.
Or even structures. Wild World. I think Wild World is a game too that doesn't really, and this is something we talk about a lot whenever Animal Crossing comes up, which might be the most talked about series on our show, especially in 2020. but I think in New Horizons, there's so much to do with the crafting, at least early on, with like when you're sort of reclaiming and rebuilding your island. But in Wild World, it really is just like you can talk to your really mean neighbors for 20 minutes and do like one thing.
Right.
And that's your time for the day. You can hang out if you want, but you don't need to.
How much is there to really do is the question, right? And I think by limiting the amount of verbs that you can like knock out on a daily basis or like in a session basis in Wild World, it means that it is a place that you're just checking in with, where I think you're totally right.
And that is so antithetical to so many mobile game design, where this is a separate conversation, but it's like in some ways you can consider mobile games like the modern handhelds.
Yeah.
And a lot of those games are built around, how do we keep you here? How do we actually limit the time you can spend and monetize spending more time?
I know we talked about it off the show, but I think it's worth bringing up. You and I checked out very briefly that game that's being marketed to everyone all of the time in every place that there is marketing space available, which is AFK Journey, a sequel to AFK Arena, which like we saw a booth for that game at PAX. We didn't go to it, but like there was a booth for that game at PAX. Like that's how big their marketing spend is. And I feel like the game is completely unavoidable, and you and I checked it out. And one of the first things I noticed when I started playing it was like when the game is loading, there's tooltips on the bottom. And one of the first ones I saw was, doctors recommend not playing this game for more than 6 hours in one session. Six.
Yep. They like legally had to say that.
Yes.
I briefly checked out AFK Arena. That was also a game that was marketed forever because I liked the art style. There were a lot of like crossover things happening.
Yeah.
And I just felt it was like, this is so like the example of the worst kind of monetization. It's like constantly. And then AFK Journey, I'm like, I'm curious to see, there's like enough of an idea to AFK Arena. I'm curious what this is all about.
Yeah.
Their marketing worked. I checked it out. And yeah, everything about it was just like, my brain actually felt numb by just the amount of like treasure chests exploding.
Yes.
And like they would introduce a character and then a second later there would be like a weirdly sexual banner for them. Like, hey, don't you want this witch?
Yeah.
Don't you want to keep playing so you can maybe get her and then get annoyed and spend $5?
Right.
And I just deleted the app. I'm like, I can't do this. Like,
yeah.
Again, this is maybe a larger conversation. But like I played Honkai Star Rail a really good amount and that game has a lot of similar practices, but it didn't feel anywhere nearly as egregious because I think there was like enough of a story happening and enough gameplay that I was genuinely enjoying that like even when the game was like showing off new characters in the story, I didn't necessarily feel like the game was constantly advertising to spend money.
Yeah.
It was really just my own pressure of like, okay, I'm playing this game for X amount of time. I kind of want a new character. Do I fold and try my hand at this or not? And plenty to critique about that game, but I think everyone has different comfort levels. And I think I'm learning like what is the too much barrier for this type of mobile game monetization?
Mm-hmm. And I think to the point that we were talking about earlier is like, yeah, as much as, you know, a MiHoYoVerse game like Honkai or Genshin Impact, like, is definitely funneling you into those microtransactions if they can be. The thing that they are definitely, definitely funneling from you is your time. They want you to be sitting there playing Genshin Impact and Honkai Star Rail like all day. They want that to be your game. You know, it goes back to conversations we've had about Bungie and the Destiny 2 team, like eventually realizing and writing blog posts about how it was actually toxic for them to make a game that it was hard to put down that would create FOMO if you like missed an event that was happening, because it meant that like, they were actively harming the mental health of their players by doing so. And I that's like a heavy it's a heavy place to take this conversation, but I think
it's worth mentioning.
I think it is. Yeah.
The design of the Playdate is like in spite of all of that, you know, it's really like, I mean, I don't think it was, they probably weren't thinking about like mobile game marketing when they made this, but I do think like for us, at least as we talk about like, what is the experience of this console, of this handheld?
Yeah.
And that is largely the experience of mobile, at least like for those big games that are free to play.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's like when that is psychologically going on, you get something like the Playdate that is built just around how do we make this as fun as possible?
Yeah.
And how do we like highlight creativity? It's really refreshing.
A side note that I think is worth bringing up while we're talking about mobile games, because I think this is actually important and interesting and will definitely come up on the show like probably sooner than later. But due to all of the pressure from the EU and the current DOJ lawsuit against Apple, they are now allowing emulators on the App Store worldwide as of like this week, like the week that this episode comes out, which means I think a thing that I've always considered about the state of mobile games is that because they're, you know, they just like run rampant and they're not really challenged as frequently as they used to be. Like there used to be a lot of indie developers making really bespoke, interesting experiences for mobile. Not that there aren't still, but like definitely not as many as there used to be in like kind of the early 2010s, like mid 2010s.
Like Angry Birds being this kind of revolutionary game.
Yes.
In some ways.
Right. Yeah.
Which like, I think became its own like media empire, of course, but.
Yeah. Like that and like all the Zach Gage stuff, you know, like all of these games that I think were in a lot of ways indicative of like what you could do if you were building games specifically for mobile devices, which we've talked about in the past. But because these games like AFK Journey are going kind of mostly unchallenged at this point, it means that they just kind of run rampant, where I think the introduction of emulators and being like, I can just play Pokemon on my phone now, does create an interesting balance and challenge to those games that are clearly just sucking time out of you. Like when you can actually open up your phone and play through like an entire fucking Dragon Quest game, which you can do already because the apps are available there. But like, you know, if you just like booted up an emulator and played a Dragon Quest or something on your phone, I think that does challenge that landscape in a way that is necessary.
I agree. It's like I could play SMT4 or I can play Honkai Star Rail.
Yeah.
And like, I mean, again, I think that game is good.
Yeah.
Like it's frustratingly good because I think there is like, they made a really good game.
Yeah.
You know, I couldn't, I played very little. So I don't want to say the AFK Journey is without any value as a game, but I just felt like the experience was loudly pointing me at the monetization over the game itself.
Yeah, same.
You know, I feel like I got more messages about spending money on the witch character than I got about learning how to play the game.
Mm-hmm.
Or just making things glow.
Yeah, know, it seems like a game that assumes that you have played so many other games like this that they don't explain any of that stuff to you. Which
sure.
That was my experience, was being like, I don't know, like, why is there this demon king that I need to fight? And why do they have 45 health bars? And why did I lose at number 4, but they still told me I won? And then it opened up a treasure. Like, I don't understand any of these mechanics. But then you go and like read the comments or like see what people are saying about this game. And they're like, it's the most generous one of these I've ever played. I'm like, if this is it, then I don't want to be experiencing it.
Yeah, exactly. And it's a shame because, again, like that, the world is beautiful and the music is great. There's a lot of stuff to admire in the craftsmanship of it. But I think you're right that like I think there's almost like a subconscious settling you do for what's available in the mobile store, where then if you have access to every game ever made, you might be more drawn. Like, I'm just going to cut the middleman and play Persona instead of playing like the pretend Persona that charges me for stuff.
Right. Like Dolphin, the GameCube emulator, runs pretty well on the iPhone from what I've heard. Like, I've never tried doing it. I'm kind of uninterested in it personally. But like for somebody out there who has a backbone or something in their bag that they take with them to work or something, like, they're gonna be able to play Wind Waker on their phone instead of AFK Journey, you know, and probably have a great time.
I will say though, I think that the Tingle quest, where he makes you his unpaid intern, might actually be more harmful to your mental health than anything AFK Journey is doing. So pros and cons.
I also wonder though, you know, when this happens, like as of this week, you know, who knows how long it's going to take for these apps to actually show up on the App Store. But like the change has already been made in the terms of service and stuff. So like people can start submitting them as soon as Monday of this week. I'm curious how long it takes for like Nintendo to do something here, because legally, like they just shut down Yuzu, which was the Switch emulator, for reasons that are very obvious if you know how Yuzu was handling their whole business, in that they were bringing in, I think, like $45,000 a month on their Patreon. They were including a bunch of like keys that they ripped from the Switch that you're not supposed to. They like decrypted a bunch of encrypted things that were there that like legally they crossed the line many, many times. But other emulators like Game Boy Advance emulators and even earlier ones, Super Nintendo, even the Nintendo DS, like all of these emulators, there isn't any like legal ramification for building those emulators. The place where the legal, you know, grayness starts to seep in is when you're talking about like adding ROMs to them and things like that, which like the emulators themselves do not come with any games. So legally, there is precedent stating that it is okay that they can provide those things. And I am starting to wonder, like, when Nintendo DS and Game Boy Advance and Game Boy Color and all of these emulators start to make their way onto the iPhone, I'm going to want to play Animal Crossing Wild World way more than I am going to want to play Animal Crossing Pocket Camp, because Wild World is just a better experience. It's a better version of Animal Crossing than Pocket Camp is.
That's what I meant by settling.
Yeah. And I just wonder, like, does Nintendo eventually, I mean, probably not, but like, do they eventually wake up and think about the fact that, hey, if people are playing Pokemon on here, why don't we sell it? Like, I would much rather give Nintendo fucking
$2 to play Pokemon Red.
I would give them $15 to play Pokemon Crystal on my phone. I like, no joke, I would pay that much, because that experience is that important to me and is worth that much to me, at least.
Yeah, I agree. I don't know why I said two, but I was trying to get a bargain.
I mean, that'd be great. I would love if it was $2.
Yeah. I would love to haggle with Nintendo and see how that goes. I'll give you $2 for this.
Hey, Reggie. Reggie's not around.
Exactly.
But I'm curious what happens here, because I think the introduction of emulators onto the iPhone is going to be very challenging in a lot of ways. I think it's going to be very interesting.
Yeah, I also think it again, like, raises question marks about how the new hardware is going to be. Like, we still don't, unless they said it and I didn't see it or read it, like, we don't know, is Nintendo Online going to carry over to the next console? Like, are these...
They said your account will. That's as much as they've said publicly.
Okay, so I would assume from that means, like, the purchases you've made, because it's all assigned to your Nintendo account.
I would also like to assume that.
I would assume that with any other company. I would say right. We have an 80% chance.
I think, like, so too. I'm definitely more optimistic than not that when they said that your account will carry over to the next console, that also means your purchases. But also knowing Nintendo, like, if they can sell Smash Ultimate a second time to me or something, they will try.
Yeah, I think it's the third party support that gives me optimism about your purchases carrying over.
Yes.
Because the idea of like buying, I don't know, Ace Attorney on Switch.
Yeah.
And then no longer having access to that, I feel like actually does create problems between Capcom and Nintendo.
I think you're completely right about that. Yeah.
That they don't want. They don't want that.
Right.
If it was like, but if we were only getting first party exclusives on the Switch, no chance in hell. It would have to start from scratch, you know?
Yeah.
Maybe backwards compatible with the physical copies. But I would guess if they said your account carries over, that means your purchases will. Whether or not Nintendo Online does, in terms of like the virtual, you know, like the SNES collection,
oh, yeah, right,
and all that stuff. Like, that stuff is so weirdly advertised to begin with. Like, every 8 months they tweet about three new games, one of which is like kind of known.
Yeah. I wonder if internally they think that that's a success. Like, I wonder if that's working for them. We will never probably hear about it.
Yeah.
But like, I'm curious if internally they're like, this is going great and people love it. Like, they might think that.
To be clear, like, I think it's better than nothing. Like, I think we've criticized them, but like, I'm glad that stuff is there. But I wonder if that does better than, say, like their Wii eStore did. That just had like, you can buy these individual games for X amount and you have them on the Wii.
Right.
Personally, I would prefer that structure. But I don't know what does better.
Yeah, I think there's something about the like looking at the revenue and knowing that every single person means this much money is coming in, and like being able to forecast revenue easier via subscription than individual purposes, which is sad, but is the truth. Because I agree with you. I would much rather just like be purchasing the stuff separately. But I think if I was like, this is a bananas thing to say, but I'm going to say it out loud. If I was like on the Nintendo board or something, and I saw that Apple was allowing emulators globally, I would be pressuring the decision makers in the company to be like, hey, we need an answer for this. And legally, globally, it's not going to be shutting down these emulators, because they've already lost that multiple times. Like, that is a case that has been brought, believe it or not, actually, Steve Jobs is one of the reasons that there is a legal precedent for emulators being allowed, which is unreal, because he licensed and worked with a company to get a PlayStation 1 emulator built into one of the Macs, and Sony tried to sue them and then lost, which is wild. And that's like the precedent that we use. I'll give a shout out to David Pierce over at The Verge for illuminating that recently on an episode of Decoder, and Sean Hollister, who is the guest on that one. But I think that that's fascinating. And I think that like Nintendo, like it would behoove them to do something. It would behoove them to make money. I know we say that all the time, but like you could either just allow these emulators to like reign unchecked, or you can sell me Pokemon Crystal and I will gladly give you money for it.
That's the thing. It's like, I mean, on one hand, it's kind of cool that there's this like bustling market of these third party devices that play this older library in ways that are probably more exciting and interesting than what Nintendo would make for them. But at the same time, like, yeah, it just feels like money on the table.
Yeah.
It's like constantly the thing with Nintendo. And I have no, you know, financial expertise here, but it just seems like an obvious low hanging fruit for them.
Yeah. And then, you know, counter to that, you have also news from this week is that Sarah Bond, who works, she's the president of Xbox, just got moved into a new division of Xbox that is all focused on game preservation and making sure that the things that you buy in your Xbox account will carry over forever. And that's a whole division that they just set up.
Yeah.
Which is like the complete antithesis of the Nintendo online subscription service.
Yeah. Yeah. So funny. I have a question about the playdate to veer us back on topic here. So the crank, I think it's really cool. I could see so clearly like a team of marketing executives being like, I love the crank. It's sexy. It's modern. It's retro. Like,
yeah, it makes a cool noise when you open it up.
It does just like immediately catch your eye because it's like kind of confusing, but in an exciting way.
Yes.
So how does it like, I guess, is it game by game in terms of what it actually does?
Yeah.
Because it seems like I saw some footage of one game where it was like you actually just continuously rotated the crank to move the character forward.
Mm-hmm.
And then but it's like the D-pad and the buttons are there. So like, do you find that it's weird to alternate between the crank and the buttons, or like?
So this is what I mean when I say that I feel like developers have, to get us really back to where we started that whole tangent.
Yes, we went on an AFK journey together. Sorry. Do you want to spend money to get this witch? Real money, I mean, like a real 20.
Centering myself, rotating the crank backwards.
AF crank.
Fuck.
Sorry. Come back.
AF crank. Starring Jason Statham.
Where the hell am I going? I need to find the right path. Maybe if I spend $5, I'll find the right way.
You're like halfway between Dragon's Dogma NPC and Jason Statham. Yeah.
The master works all, can't go wrong.
Yeah. It's like they're like voice director, you know, put out the casting call, like, who can do a pretty good Jason Statham?
There's that one guy in Skyrim that like kind of sounds like him, but is clearly not in the Thieves Guild.
Yeah.
So you want to learn how to pick a lock.
Yeah, great.
Yeah, anyway.
The crank.
The crank.
I think generally speaking, developers have considered this device and considered everything about how you're going to play games on it. Steven is still losing it behind the microphone.
I really liked that joke. I'm very proud of myself. I look like I'm a Dragon's Dogma NPC who just gave flowers. I'm like blushing and smiling. Ooh, okay.
The two things I'll say about the games on the playdate.
Yes.
Number one, most of them, not all of them, but most of them are built for pretty short play sessions, which I think is cool. Most of them are built to like be to make sure that the playdate is a device that you can just pull out of your pocket and play in the like free moments you have in between stuff, which I think is very cool. The other thing that I think is really important is that a lot of these developers have really considered that if they're putting a heavy emphasis on using the crank, it also means that like you can't be simultaneously pressing the A and B buttons,
right?
Unless they want it to feel frenetic. And there are a couple of games that I've played where the experience of using the crank and like needing to be very careful about which way you are rotating the crank will occasionally be broken up by like, okay, I need you to press the B button right now. And you're like, how do I do both of these things simultaneously? And that's fun in like a WarioWare way.
I was thinking of WarioWare as you were saying that. This feels like the WarioWare device, honestly.
It, Yeah, it really does. That is like really kind of the energy here with some of these games. It's like, what if you took a WarioWare minigame and turned it into a full experience that you could play, which is very cool. But there are some games where like, okay, if we're focused on the crank specifically, like if that's the main method that you're using to play the game, then they have understood by holding the device themselves and like beta testing and play testing and all of these things that like, if you're rotating the crank, you can also be holding on to the device with your left hand and using the D-pad. So like you can use the D-pad while simultaneously rotating the crank either way pretty well. I've also played another game. I forget which one it was. Not one of the ones I'm going to list, I think. But I played another game where the crank is super important and you're using it all the time. And the only other button you press is B, which means that you have like a really firm grip on the device. So you're like cranking and at any moment, you just press the B button. And I think that, that was very smart. And then again, there are some games that are like all about being frenetic. There are some games where the crank like comes into play just for specific actions here and there. I think that developers have been very smart about it. There's one, I think, if you'll permit me, I think it's time to start talking about games on the playdate.
Yeah, why don't we take a break here?
You're right, we should take
come
a break.
Back. Yeah, take a break here and come back with some games.
Yeah, bye-bye. Hello, Steven.
Hey.
Before we even get into these games, I do want to shout out that if you are a The Worst Garbage.online fan, if you're a person who listens to multiple podcasts on this network, unbelievably, for the second time in I think as many months, I and Chase, the host of Video Game Podtimism, have completely aligned. Their episode from this week is also about the playdate because Chase also got one this week.
That rocks.
So there are a couple of games that Chase brought to that show, and the two of them talked about it a whole bunch on that episode. I would recommend going and listening to it. There's only one that I will have overlap on. There's one that I think we do need to talk about.
Okay.
But there are some other ones that Chase brought to that episode, which I think are great. One of them is called Under the Castle, which I was going to talk about initially, but I think you should go listen to them talk about it because Chase is like irreverent about it, which I think is fun. But the one that I definitely want to lead with that they also talked about on that episode is called Mars After Midnight. It's a recent release, but it's one of the games that I believe was advertised around the launch of the playdate. So it's been in the works for a long time. And it's one of the first games where I saw the crank being used and was like, oh my God, that thing is so cool. I would like to play one eventually. The big thing about Mars After Midnight is that it's by Lucas Pope, who did Papers, Please and Return of the Obra Dinn. And this feels a lot to me like, what if Papers, Please wasn't miserable? Because Papers, Please is a pretty hardcore game. It's like deeply sad.
Intentionally, in terms of the story it's trying to tell. But yeah, it's not something you would probably play more than once.
Right.
Even though it is like mechanically fun, despite its, you know, harrowingness.
Yes. Which, you know, that's all the point, which it's a great game. It's a classic for a reason. It's available on mobile. It's available everywhere. I would recommend playing it if you haven't. And Return of the Obra Dinn, also similarly, like a classic, maybe single-handedly revitalizing and like changing the landscape of mysteries and detective games.
Yeah, I feel like that has really paved the way for stuff like Case of the Golden Idol and other, what was it, Paradise Killer. There's so many like new like detective games.
Yeah.
That have followed Obra Dinn's success, and they're all, you know, remarkably different as well.
Yeah, but what I think is interesting about the overlap between all of these games is it feels a lot like some of the mechanics of Papers, Please meets the art style of Return of the Obra Dinn, given the, you know, monochromatic and kind of not quite 8-bit energy of the screen on the playdate. So Mars After Midnight is a game where you are a 3-eyed like bird alien living on a Mars colony who runs a community service center, which has like support groups for a bunch of different kinds of aliens who also live on this colony. And the very first one is a Cyclops anger management thing that you're throwing.
Oh my God.
And the way the game works is twofold. There's like two main mechanics here. The first one is if you're throwing this Cyclops anger management thing, you have this door with like a peephole, kind of like a big like rectangular peephole. And someone will knock on the door and the screen will just show you the peephole, and you use the crank to open the peephole and see who is on the other end. So in the case of the Cyclops anger management course, you have to check and see if they only have one eye or if they have multiple eyes. And if they have multiple eyes, that means you just close the peephole and you're like, no, thank you. Like, you're not who we're looking for here. If they have one eye, you can also see if they're smiling or if they're sad. And if they're smiling, it's like, you don't need to be here, catch you later. And if they're sad, then you let them in. So you're using the crank literally to just like open and close the peephole, which is so fun. It's like such an incredible and like tactile experience to be rotating the crank and like seeing, and you know, whenever the peephole opens also, like these aliens are all mostly procedurally generated. Like, some of them are hand-drawn, but some of them are, like, procedurally generated. And they're all just, like, really kind of, like, sometimes cute, sometimes grotesque, like, sometimes just, like, completely out of left field designs.
It's like Tender was like that, too. Creature Comforts.
Yeah, it does feel a little bit like that. Yeah. When you open the peephole, you'll see the alien, and then they'll usually just go, like, murr, or, like, some version of, like, probably hello, or, like, you know, murr. Or something. The sound design here is great. And when you let them in, they kind of like shuffle their way into the community center. And the second main mechanic of the game is that you have this refreshments table. And the first one is just this like pie that has six slices. So you can let six people, or you can let six aliens into this support group. So they'll like shuffle their way over to the refreshment table and they'll like take a slice of pie. And usually in the process, they'll like fuck up everything that's on the table. So the next mechanic of the game is you need to use your tentacles to lift up all of the different things on the table. So like the pie and the like sign that says that there's a pie and all of the bowls and stuff, or all of the plates. You need to hold them all up in the air and you use the crank to vacuum all of the like, you know, detritus off of the table. And then you need to place everything back where it's supposed to be. And while that's happening, you need to do it quickly because there are still people outside like knocking on the door. So you're trying to like juggle all of this stuff. And the reason you're doing all of this is that you get paid if people think that the support group was helpful, but you also get a tip if they like the refreshments. So if you can do all of this stuff fast enough and make sure that you are keeping the refreshments table like clean and orderly and good, while also simultaneously like providing a good service and like making sure there are enough aliens there to like make it useful, you end up walking away with a bunch of money that you can then use to throw another community service event the next night. So the whole deal is that it's like some kind of shop or like some kind of like industrial plant or something by day. And then at midnight, it turns into this community center that you run. So when you're done with a night of a community service thing, you then choose what the next support group you want to throw is. So there's one that I did recently that's it's called Farty Party. And the whole deal is like it's for aliens that can't stop farting. So you needed to open up the crank and then you would like just kind of hang out with them like on the other side of the door. They just be like, "Wah, wah." And if they farted, then you let them in. But if they didn't fart, like you would just sit there for a long time. It's like if they didn't fart, it's like you don't need to be here. Why are you here at the farty party? And that's great. The game is very funny. And this feels to me like one of the best, like, holistic experiences I've had on the playdate so far. It just feels like this game that's like super considered. Why would you be using, you know, the crank? Why would you be using, you know, the A and B button? And why would you be using the D-pad? They're also, you know, making use of sound in a really interesting way. I just think overall, it's like the whole package. It feels like one of the best examples of why this device is so cool. And having somebody like Lucas Pope make a game like this, I think is wonderful. And I also think even, you know, taking a step back again, the fact that it is irreverent and funny and, you know, not so much tonally like his other releases, you know, Papers, Please and Oberdin are both pretty hardcore in different ways. I think for him to take a step back also and say like, hey, it would be nice if this game was like fun and cool and cute in some ways was really smart. And I just think it is like everything that you would want a game on the playdate to be. So Chase talked about that on Podtimism, but I think like you can't not talk about Mars After Midnight.
That helps me also get a firmer idea of the experience of this console. And I think it's interesting because I think when we talk about the history of games, I find myself often commenting how like in the 90s, you know, I mean, I grew up in the 90s. So like in my memory of game discussions in the 90s and even like how parents referred to them in the 90s and 2000s, games were often talked about as if they were a toy or a plaything and not, you know, art. And it's almost like we've spent so much time, we meaning like people who, you know, grew up playing games, the people who work on games, people who are advertising games, like people who are in the game world have spent decades be like, no, this is art. It is more than a toy.
Yeah.
It has meaning. It's like we've been spending so much time doing that like leaning back into like, what if it was a toy though? What if it was like you cranked the thing and you know, a Cyclops farted? Like you could actually, with intentionality, make that really interesting and also make that art as well.
Yes.
So I like this sort of full circle nature of the playdate in that sense.
honestly, that's what a lot of stuff on the playdate feels like. It does feel like, hey, we built this thing from the ground up to be very fun and very funny and very irreverent, but also like the art is frequently blowing me away, or the writing is great, or like there's always some like standout thing that just like really blows my mind about it. I think the next one that I should definitely talk about, I would say pound for pound, this is my favorite game on the playdate so far. I think Mars After Midnight is like a great example, you know, not to like pit all these games against each other. Like Mars After Midnight is a great example of what the playdate is great at. But like this next game is called Satellite, S-A-T-O, like capital O-L-I-T-E. Satellite is a tower defense game on here that I like can't stop playing. Like even, you know, I didn't have that much time to play all of these games, or as much time as I wanted, honestly. And even with my limited time that I had, I just kept opening Satellite instead of playing other games because I just like love it so much. But the way it works is it's a tower defense game where you are given a planet or multiple planets which have discrete orbits. So you're just like seeing the planet as a circle, and you can see the orbit either going clockwise or counterclockwise. And you have a set amount of money, and you use that money to buy essentially turrets or like satellites that will orbit the planet that you're on. And then alien enemy ships will fly in from the right side of the screen, and kind of like a balloon's tower defense or something, if they hit the other side of the screen, that means that you lose. You have like a limited amount of lives, and you need to make sure that your satellites are taking out these ships before they, you know, make it to the other side of the screen. And where you start to run into the challenge of this game is the amount of money is very limited. So, you know, you can't buy a billion satellites. You have to be very intentional about how you're buying them and how you're placing them. But you also need to make sure that when you place a satellite in orbit, it's going to just keep rotating around the planet. And there are instances in which like a ship will be on the exact 180 opposite side of the planet that your satellite is on, so it can't hit there. So you need to make sure that you have enough range, or you've placed them well enough that they will be able to take out those ships as they come in. And they obviously start to, you know, ratchet up the difficulty, increase the different kinds of satellites that you get. So like at first you only just have like a laser beam that fires like one every second. You eventually get a rapid fire one that does less damage but fires more frequently. You also will get like EMP blasts, which will be able to remove shields off of enemies. And the game starts to fuck with you, I think, in really fun ways, because the whole conceit of this is that it's like this cartoon dog general is like issuing you all these commands, but he's not that on top of things when it comes to the actual war front. So like before every single mission, they'll give you a little briefing that'll be like, hey, there's a bunch of enemies with shields coming in. We've just like equipped you with these EMP blasts, which should take them out, but they don't do any damage. So you're gonna need to worry about that. Great little tutorial mission. The next time you'll start the mission and he just won't show up, and then you'll get like halfway into it, he'll be like, I'm so sorry, I overslept, I didn't realize, it seems like you're doing fine, I guess we don't need to like tell you how to do this one, or something like that. And sometimes I did this one mission recently where they forgot the password to their bank account, so they couldn't give me any starting money, so I just had like one laser for like half of this encounter before they like figured out what the password was, and then gave me $100 that I could spend on a second laser. Stuff like that, I think, really works for me and makes the game more than like something that could only exist on the playdate, but like even reach outside of that and be like, I would play this anywhere. Like I think that this game would be great no matter where it was. Where they use the crank, I think, is great. Like you know, all of these games are kind of just using the crank in a different way. There are some that just don't use it at all, but most of them do. The way that this game works is when you go to place a laser in orbit, you use the D-pad to choose which of the planets you want, because every level has a different amount of planets and they're different sizes and all this different stuff. So you choose what planet you want with the D-pad, and you can see this kind of like tracer ring around the planet that shows you which direction the orbit is going, and you use the crank to go around the planet and decide where you want that laser to be placed. It's really, really, really good. It's like an incredibly well-designed video game with really, for some reason, funny dialogue that like actually does make me laugh out loud all the time. I think that this game is super special. This one is available in the catalog. It's worth mentioning, so is Mars After Midnight. A lot of the games I'm going to be talking about are from the catalog. I will note if I got them from Itch instead and sideloaded them on, because there are a couple that I've gotten from Itch. But Satellite is on the catalog right now. All of these games, again, are like relatively cheap, which is pretty surprising. But Satellite is great.
It sounds awesome. I definitely want a play date, Brendan.
Yeah. Well, buckle the fuck up.
Persona 6 Playdate exclusive.
I would actually, you know what? We can just skip to this one. I did get this one on itch. I already told you about it, but I got Celeste. Like, somebody just ported Celeste Classic from the Pico 8 onto the Playdate.
That's awesome.
And it rocks. It's great. Like, hey, guess what?
What do they use the crank for?
Nothing. It's just Celeste.
Yeah, that would be cruel to ask you. I can maybe see it for climbing, but like then, that's a lot to ask.
Yeah, that's a game where you really need your hand on the D-pad and the buttons at all times.
Yeah. I want motion control Celeste. Just make it as hard nightmare. As possible.
Yeah. I'm sure it's like Maddie Thorson's ears perked up. But what if? Anyway, Celeste is great. It's on itch. I think it's free because it's just a port of an already free Pico 8 game. So you can just go get that and sideload it on there, which I did. And it's great. I want to talk about this other one because it's another one that I think is just like really special. It's not really using the crank too much, but it is just like an interesting conceit for a game. And I think also makes really interesting use of this idea that like, hey, this is a device that you should check in with every once in a while. It's this game called Bloom. And the whole pitch of this game is that you are a person who dropped out of college to start a flower shop. And you have an apartment that is right above the flower shop. And on the roof of the apartment is the garden where you grow the flowers that you sell in the flower shop. And the only use of the crank that I've seen so far in this game are, one, when you're in your apartment, you can open up your phone and like receive and send text messages back and forth to different people. So like your landlord who you need to pay rent to, your partner who texts you every once in a while, and just like other people in your life randomly. You use the crank to like scroll through text messages, which is, you know, just feels good. Just feels good to like scroll through the text. And you also use the crank to take the elevator between the rooftop and your apartment. So you just literally go up and down and that's it. There's really not a whole lot else going on from a crank perspective, but I think the game is really smart because the whole thing, and this is brilliant to me because it's using the Wi-Fi specifically to keep track of like what time it is wherever you are and wherever you are.
Oh, cool.
And I don't know this for sure, but I do think it's also checking the local weather for wherever you are, because at least for now, there's a forecast app on your phone and it does match up with my actual forecast here. And I don't know if that's literally just like a coincidence or if that is actually happening, but it's a game that totally takes place in real time. So like when you check in, you know, at 1:04 p.m. on Sunday, it will be 1:04 p.m. on Sunday in the game. And that means that like there are times where your shop is open. There are times where your shop is closed. You have days where you're open and closed and you need to be, you know, checking in with your plants and growing them and, you know, getting rid of weeds and like cleaning up the area on your rooftop. But for the most part, it's just a game that seems to unfold very slowly. It is the closest I think that we have to something like an Animal Crossing on the playdate, where you should just check in, you know, like Wild World specifically, your point about Wild World, like you should just check in and play for like 5 minutes once or twice a day at most, you know, just make sure that the plants are watered. Nothing has gone like totally awry in the shop or whatever. You don't have a text message waiting for you that's like dire or something. And I love it. I love this game. I think it is like kind of the ideal playdate experience that doesn't use the crank that much because it is still making use of the other things that make the playdate really special, I think.
Right. I really love retro devices that have something modern about them.
Yeah.
And I think this it's essentially what the playdate is. Making use of the Wi-Fi for the actual game design is very interesting. I guess when you have so few elements to work with, you have to decide, okay, are we designing around the crank or the monochromatic nature of the display or the Wi-Fi even?
Right.
Like the fact that Wi-Fi is like one of the four pieces is so funny because that's just like assumed for most games. You know?
Right. Yeah. I most of the game, like Satellite, for example, I think is one of them. And some of the like roguelikes and stuff, they're just really using the Wi-Fi to like check for updates and also upload your high scores to the leaderboard. For Bloom to like really make use of it in this other way, I think is really special. Honestly, there's another game that makes use of a feature I didn't even know. I wasn't even gonna bring this one up, but I think I should. I haven't played it enough, but it's just like a great idea. So if that's kind of like what if Animal Crossing was on the playdate, this one is a little bit like what if Pokemon was on the playdate. And they even went as far as releasing two versions. So it's a game that's called Shining Gadget or Shadow Gadget.
Cool.
Actually, I'm gonna open it up so you can hear it, because I think you'll like love the sound that plays when you open this game up.
Welcome to Shining Gadget!
Oh, wow. Yes.
So, that's the sound of an alarm telling me that there is a ghost detected. So instead of being a Pokemon game where you're like walking around in a big RPG and doing stuff, instead what is happening is, I think this is also based on the real-time clock, every once in a while a ghost will show up, and it's only about catching the ghost. And the way in which you catch the ghost when it shows up is it uses the, again, didn't realize this was part of the playdate, the accelerometer in the playdate, and has this big grid with like a target that you have to hit, and you need to like move the playdate around in your hand to make sure that you are balancing it perfectly on that target on this space, which is very difficult to do. And when you get it in that little target, you then need to crank as quickly as you possibly can to suck the ghost into kind of like a Ghostbusters-esque ghost trap. And the target starts moving. You know, it's not so unlike an accelerometer-based version of the Stardew Valley fishing minigame in that way,
where you
like need to make sure that you're like in that hot zone, but you're also like literally moving one hand to balance the thing and using the other hand to crank really hard, which is obviously going to throw you off balance. And if you do that, then you catch the ghost, and the ghost gets uploaded to like your online database that you can just check. They apparently built an app that you can just like download and check your collection anywhere, and then also use the app to trade ghosts with other people. And that's how you can trade between Shining and Shadow Gadget.
That's so good.
Yeah, it rocks. It's like, it's such an interesting idea to me, like just to make this Pokemon S game where the only thing you do is capture them, and it's completely random like when they show up also.
Yeah, I feel like that's, it's, we talk a lot about Pokemon on the show, obviously, and one of our more recent conversations is like, what do we actually want Pokemon to do? Because obviously, like, you know, it's a series that is just starting to try to evolve and change things. And I think you and I really loved the direction that Arceus went in and liked Scarlet and Violet, but, you know, we're let down by aspects of it. And I think sort of the design by subtraction philosophy that's inherent to Playdate's design of just like, what if it was just one thing? I think Arceus is a game that leaned into catching over fighting. And I like the idea of like, just not even have the fight, just have the collection aspect.
Yeah.
But make catching really fun.
Yes.
You know, make that like a really hectic thing that you have to focus the entire game around.
Yeah. So yeah, it, like whenever you turn on the play date, you know, you could just hop into Shadow Gadget or Shining Gadget real quick and just like see if there's a ghost there waiting for you. Sometimes there is and sometimes there isn't. But if there is, like the big alarm goes off and it's like, do you want to try and catch this thing right now? And you say yes, you have a really hectic experience, and it's like, okay, well, you know, check in some other time. You know, it's kind of like it's kind of like Bloom, where like you should check in once or twice a day. Like similarly with Shadow Gadget, like I just open it up once or twice a day and see if there's a ghost there waiting for me. And usually there is, but sometimes there's not, and I think that's like equally fun to not know.
Also, that title screen voice, one of the many big takeaways I had from our Dreamcast episode is that I love when games are pumped to be themselves.
Yeah, they just
like when you turn them
on,
they're just like, this game fucking rocks. And it's like people dancing and like, exactly. Like, so good. I love that stuff. Any fight, I mean, because a lot of them were arcade games, so they have to grab your attention in the arcade.
Yeah.
But even just having that isolated from the arcade is even funnier. It's just like, I'm playing it. I got it. Like, you have to yell at me.
I press the button to open it. Yeah, you don't need to beckon me over. So the next game, I need to just shout out real quick. This very much, I mean, this is, again, none of these games really are tech demos, but this is definitely the game. Like, I went to a party last night and brought the playdate with me to just like show to some people who I knew would really love it. And this is the game that you hand to people to show them why the playdate rocks. It's called Root Bear. Apparently it became like a bigger deal outside of the playdate. Like it was like big on TikTok for some reason. I mean, I know the reasons, but like it became big like outside of the playdate. But the idea of Root Bear is very simple. There is a bear who works at a bar that sells root beer, and there's just a cup that shows up. This is the most WarioWare game on the playdate, definitely. I think it's also like a dollar. But there's a bear, like a cartoonish bear, kind of like Ren and Stimpy adjacent, I would say, in terms of like its design. And they work at this place that sells root beer. There's a cup that shows up, and the cup has a line on it, and you need to use the crank to pour root beer into that cup. And as it's, you know, flowing in, there's like the like foamy head that kind of forms. And you need to then unwind the crank to turn off the tap. And you need to try and get as perfect as you possibly can on that line. And the bear is very discerning. The bear will lose its fucking mind no matter what you do, unless it's like fine. Like you will frequently get pours that are just fine. It'll be like, yeah, that was okay. And like, you'll see, he just kind of like shrugs it off. If you overflow the cup, he will literally turn into like the nightmare version of a Ren and Stimpy character and do the actual Wilhelm scream out of the playdate. It is horrifying. And then if you get it right, then he, you know, like a bunch of flowers show up and like hearts everywhere. And he's like, perfect pour. You know, it's like just a great experience. And I think it's one of those ones that like kind of like having Wii Sports on your Wii, like just to make sure that whenever somebody comes over, like you always have Wii Sports ready to go. This is one of those games that will just like always be on my play date no matter what, just to like show people why it's great. Because it is, you know, similarly crank only, just like so irreverent and weird and funny. And like I think every round of Root Bear takes 30 seconds, so you really don't have that much time. And also it's uploading your score to the leaderboard, so you can, you know, see how good you're doing against the other people.
That's so fun. I love that.
Yeah, the game rocks, man. What's next? There's so many good games here. Okay, so like unsurprisingly, one of the things I checked for pretty immediately was if there are any roguelikes on here, because it feels to me like as I started to play more of these games, I started to kind of come around and realize that a lot of these games were being developed for these very quick play sessions. And I was kind of curious what that looks like on a handheld like this in particular, because I feel like a lot of the roguelikes I've been playing recently and that we've talked about on the show recently, I mean, even like, you know, going as far back as like a Hades or a Spelunky, but like a Balatro, for example, runs can last a really long time. Like I think we've gotten into this space where a roguelike in a lot of instances means that if a run is going well, if you get good enough at a game, a run can be like 30 minutes, 40 minutes, an hour. Like, you know, Vampire Survivors is, I think, a great example of that, where like winning a run of Vampire Survivors, it was exciting to people that it could only take 30 minutes because so many roguelikes have now exceeded that length by a pretty wide margin when you were like winning.
Yeah, that might also be a pain point in one of our recent favorites, Astral Ascent, which is a great roguelite, but runs are so long that I think it might be pushing away potential new players. It's just like, it's asking a lot of you.
I think so too.
Yeah.
If you need to save and quit in the middle of a run, I think that ruins the flow state that you want to be in when you're playing a roguelike.
Exactly.
There's this one arcade game I play on my phone a lot and have for years called Domino Drop. And I wrote a piece a long time ago that was like a kind of minute-by-minute breakdown of my day from like my commute when I wake up until when I came home that night, and like when I play Domino Drop, like one round of Domino Drop throughout that entire experience, and how it's so easy in arcade games like that, but also roguelikes, to like get into these flow states where you're like, I'm killing it, I'm doing well, but then the run lasts so long you need to stop. And then when you come back, you're no longer in the flow state that you need to be to like continue that run, and then you end up losing it. Like, I think as soon as you cross that Rubicon of time, the roguelikiness starts to kind of fall apart a little bit.
Yeah, I have that even with Balatro, which is less of a fault of Balatro and more that I start runs too late before bed. And I'll be like, I'm like halfway, I need to like save this and start again later. And then I'll have no idea. I'll forget like what the synergies were and what I was building around. Like, all the information is there, but it does throw you out of the loop for sure.
Yeah. So on the play date, there are a bunch of roguelikes. I saw that there is somebody trying to port Spelunky Classic onto the play date, which would be, I think, a dream scenario for me. If that ever happens, I'm going to lose my mind. But there are two really great roguelikes that I think are worth shouting out. Number one is called Under the Castle. They talked about it on Video Game Podtimism. I'd recommend it. I think it is like the best roguelike in terms of understanding the time constraints of when you would want to be playing the playdate, because the whole conceit is that you are trying to liberate a castle, and there are only three areas that you can go into, and you can just like very easily go into one area and like liberating an area or like accomplishing the goal in I think it's the mines, the crypt, and the sewers, and they each have three separate goals for when you go into each of them. Accomplishing that goal will take like maybe 30 seconds at most. Like, you will know if you are successful or not immediately, and you can then from that point just close the game and come back later when you want to keep doing it. So runs aren't really runs at all. It's just kind of like a slow march towards victory, hopefully. But it is still a roguelike. You could still fuck up. But the other game that I wanted to shout out is called Rend Sword, R-E-N-D Sword. This game is brilliant. This is a game that I think could also very easily just show up elsewhere, and I would absolutely go to bat for it any day of the week. But it is a game where you open it up and there's a sword that is like, hello, I'm the mystical sword. You and I are going to work together to, you know, achieve wonders and, you know, kill a dark lord or whatever. And the sword asks you what your name is, and it doesn't present you with like a keyboard or anything to enter your name. Instead, it gives you a bunch of options of first names. So it'll be like, is your name Susanna? Is your name Jonathan? Is your name whatever? You know, it'll just like have a bunch of names, and you choose one of those names, and it'll say, what is your last name? And it will also similarly present you with a bunch of last names. You pick that last name, and the sword says, your name is your weapon. use it wisely. And all of the letters of the name that you chose become the deck of cards that you're using. So it's like,
oh, cool.
It is a deck building roguelike where different letters of the alphabet are assigned different attack and defense values. And you're making your way. It's like a dungeon crawling roguelike. So you'll be presented with like a bat at the beginning of the game that has like 10 health. And you have a bunch of letters on the bottom of your screen that are like randomly selected from this deck based on the name that you chose. And you need to make a word out of those letters, kind of like Scrabble. And if you can make a word and you use it, it will do the amount of damage that is assigned to each of those letters and different character values. So like vowels are obviously very easy to fit into words, so they do less damage than something like an X or a Q or something. And when you defeat enemies, you get either new letters added to your deck, or it will upgrade certain letters. So like, oh, an S will now stun an enemy instead of doing damage. Or, you know, you'll just get a bunch of different like kinds of letters and different kinds of upgrades. But you are just like building a deck, and every once in a while they'll be like, do you want to remove a card from your deck instead of upgrading a card? So you get that like Slay the Spire thing as well.
Yeah.
But the crank, great use of the crank. The way the crank comes into play is like you could ignore it entirely if you want to. Like if you're good at a game like Scrabble or like a Wordle or a Not Words or something like that, like if you have like word game brain, you'd be totally fine not using the crank at all. If you feel like you need a little bit of help, you can rotate the crank and it will just randomly shuffle the letters that you have available to you. And as you continue to crank, it will just continue to shuffle the letters. So like maybe it'll just land on a word and then you're like, oh yeah, I didn't realize that the word like cause was in front of me the whole time, but here it is.
That's awesome.
Really smart use of the crank. But this is one of those games where like, yo, if you put this on the iPhone or the Switch or the Steam Deck or like anything, I would play this all the time. Like if I had this on my phone, I'd be playing this constantly. It is just like an amazing idea for a roguelike, no matter where it is. But being on the playdate, I think, makes it slightly more fun in a lot of ways. That's Rend Sword, R-E-N-D Sword. It's so good. It's really good.
It sounds awesome.
Yeah. That's the other one besides Satellite that I just like keep opening. I think now is a good time to just mention, I think I'm in this place with the playdate right now, considering like its battery life, how quick it is to charge, how much fun it is, how weird it is. I think I just am going to like bring this with me on my commute for the next couple of weeks instead of the Miu Mini, which has been like my go-to for a long time. Just to see, like, what is it like playing the playdate outside? Like, what is it like opening up Shadow Gadget and trying to capture a ghost on the subway?
On the subway,
you know, like
with the crank.
Yeah. Right. Like I'm just really curious what that experience is going to be like. So I'm going to start doing that.
If balancing a playdate on your hand and using the crank to catch a ghost is somehow more convenient than carrying the Switch, Nintendo has a lot of rethinking to do.
I agree.
With the size of their portable console.
I totally agree. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think just like between Satellite and Rend Sword, I just kind of, and also honestly, like Bloom, like being able to check in with Bloom every once in a while, like I just want to have the playdate with me more frequently. And I think that's one of the like, going back to the thing I brought up earlier about like Apple introducing the App Store to the iPhone after it came out, like Apple didn't totally know what people were going to build for that thing. But what ended up happening was a bunch of people made apps that made you want to use the iPhone more. So that ended up being a net positive for Apple no matter what. Like, wasn't just that people were making like cool apps or like, you know, stupid apps like, oh, look, this beer is, you know, flowing out of the iPhone, like the weird beer apps that for some reason were everywhere.
I forgot about that. Yeah.
But eventually you got to a point where it's like, oh, this is useful, or this is fun, or this is a thing that I want to check frequently. And then you eventually get to a point where things are fucked up about that. But the playdate, not so much. The playdate is like, if you have a game like Bloom and it asks you to check in once or twice a day, like that's fine by me. Same with Shadow Gadget. And then every once in a while, like while you're there, while you've checked with Bloom and Shadow Gadget, why not open up Rend Sword and like go through a run real quick and see how it goes? The thing about Rend Sword is that runs do last longer than a game like Under the Castle, the one I mentioned before. Under the Castle is like you could just jump in very quickly and get out. Rend Sword can go for a while, but I just think the game is so good I don't even really care. Like it's just a great video game, man. What's next? What should we talk about? Here's one I got from Itch. This one is called Pocket Pets. There's two reasons to bring this up. Number one, it is just a Tamagotchi, and that's great. Somebody should have made a Tamagotchi for the playdate, and then somebody did, and it's called Pocket Pets, and you can get it. It's great. The other thing is that you level up the pocket pet by battling. And battle essentially is like a Mega Man, oh my God, what is it called? Mega Man Battle Network game.
Oh yeah, yeah. Like the 3x12 grid or whatever it is.
So in this case, you have a 3x3 grid, and the enemy is on a 1x3 grid, like vertically. And the way the game works is your little Tamagotchi pet, you like move them around with the D-pad and you press the A button to like plant seeds in these spots on the grid. And eventually those seeds will grow into a plant. And when you press A on the plant, it will attack along that row. So if the enemy is in that row and you press the attack, like if the seed has grown and then you stand on the seed and you press A on that seed and you use the attack, that attack will then hit the enemy if they are also on that row. But also, the enemy is obviously attacking you. It's very frenetic. It's way more frenetic than Mega Man Battle Network in that the enemies are always attacking and you are always trying to run around and plant seeds and then grow them and then shoot them. I think that this by itself is just an amazing video game. Like, I think it's very cool that it's in Pocket Pets and I like it a lot. But I found myself this morning, I woke up like way before Persia and I just opened up the play date. I checked Bloom, I checked Shadow Gadget, and then I immediately opened a Pocket Pets to see how my Tamagotchi was doing. And instead of actually checking in on my Tamagotchi, I just played this battle thing for like 20 minutes because I just had like a really good run going.
Do you get to choose like your Tamagotchi at all? Like, or do you just kind of get randomly assigned one? Or is there just one that you get?
You get one at the start that I think is randomly assigned and then you can get more later, but it's similar to, maybe it's not similar. I don't even really know how to describe. It's you just get an egg, and what that egg hatches into, I think, is, you know, maybe at random. And obviously that's where the crank comes in, is like you kind of rotate the crank and the egg shakes back and forth until it hatches into this like little cute monster. But yeah, I have never been very good at maintaining Tamagotchis, so mine is not in a great way right now, but it sure has leveled up like 8 times because I keep playing this battle thing over and over again. It's just really
fun. So you're essentially the Gary Oak of this Tamagotchi universe. Yeah.
Anyway, that's called Pocket Pets. I got that one off itch.io. I only have a couple more. One that is very similar, I think, in a lot of ways to Mars After Midnight or like a Papers, Please. It's by Xavier Nelson Jr., who did An Airport in Space Currently Run by Dogs. And and, you know, just like 1.5 billion games recently. This one's called Recommendation Dog. And the way it works is you are a dog who works at like a, honestly, like Hello Work from Like a Dragon. You are like a employment placing service. So you're this dog who has a big Rolodex in front of him, and you know, scroll through the Rolodex by using the crank. So you press the down button to look at your Rolodex and scroll through it, and you press the up button to see an employer who has walked through the door, and they will, you know, just be like leaning on the door in some way, shape, or form, and they'll just be like, I need an artist who's not reliable. And you just like look down at your big Rolodex, and you can see on the top left every single person in the Rolodex has, you know, just like artist, entertainer, physician, teacher, whatever, you know, just like whatever the thing is. But then they have like a baseball card of stats and also a little profile picture. And you just need to like whip. You don't have any time at all. Like, there's a little timer that's like counting down. So as soon as somebody walks in the door, it's like, I need an artist who's unreliable. You have like 5 seconds to scroll through your Rolodex and find an artist who's unreliable. And one of the stats is obviously like reliability. You just need to find one that's low. So you're like scrolling through, you see artists. You're like, oh my God, is this? Oh, no, they're very reliable. And then you keep scrolling and then you find one that is unreliable. And they're like, thanks. And they go off. And then somebody else comes in who's like, I need a teacher who is super fast. I need them like ASAP. And then there's like a speed stat. So you're like scrolling through trying to find a teacher who's fast. That's the whole game. It's really great. It's another one that's just like super simple and I think very fun. This one I also got off itch. I was just mostly curious about it, I think, more than anything, because I saw some people. So it's worth mentioning, like, the playdate is great in that it has the catalog. You can search through the catalog there. You can also go to play.date and hit the game section. And there's, again, a big catalog, and they've made a bunch of like, kind of like the App Store has, you know, different sections where they'll like highlight a bunch of different games. Like, hey, these are really fun match three games. You can tap through and see all the match three games. On the playdate store, you can also see like, here's shoot 'em ups, here's, you know, RPGs, here's whatever. And they also have sections that are like they did like an awards thing at the end of 2023. That's like the best of play dates. Like, here's the best art, here's the best, you know, use of the crank, here's the best game made in the SDK that we put out, here's the best game made not in the SDK that we put out, stuff like that, which is very cool. I think they've done a really great job at curating that stuff. But I think what is more interesting to me are the little communities that have popped up around the internet that are like people playtesting games, people shouting out indie games. You know, obviously itch.io has the playdate section that I talked about before. So you can just like see all the playdate games there. But this is a game that I found on the playdate subreddit. Somebody just asked like, hey, are there any text-based adventures for the playdate? And I was like, that sounds really interesting to me. So I found this one that's called the Simorgh, S-I-M-O-R-G-H, which I'm probably pronouncing wrong. I think it's a French word because it's based off of a French short horror story, I think. And it is literally just a text adventure on the playdate. And you don't use the crank for anything. You just press A and B to choose between text options, and it's very good. And I kind of don't want to say anything about it, except if you have a Playdate, you should probably check it out. I have died in pretty horrifying ways and have not beaten the game yet. But the whole thing doesn't take very long. The whole thing, from what I understand, the whole thing takes like 10 to 20 minutes total. But it's very good. It's called The Simorgh, and I got that off Itch. The last one I'll shout out that I think you would find interesting, it's called MDMA, Mega Dystopia Micro Architect. And it's a city builder. It's a whole ass city builder on the Playdate. And I think the thing that's very interesting about this is it feels to me like a dystopian version of Dorf Romantik in some ways. Like the whole the whole idea of it is that you were trying to like maximize profits and maximize output in the tiles that you're placing on this grid. So you start with a pretty sparse grid. I think it's like a 4x4 grid, and they'll just give you a couple tiles like in Dorf Romantik. So they'll be like, hey, here's like a farm tile. You put a farm tile down. Here's a factory tile. If you put the factory next to the farm, that will make the farm produce less. So you need the factory kind of off in its own area. If you have like a potato plant that you want to set up, or like a potato, whatever, I forget what the actual tiles are, but like a thing that synergizes well with the farm, you put them next to each other. You put a bunch of farms next to each other. They continue to synergize together. If the air pollution from the factory makes its way over to the farm, then that's obviously bad, and vice versa. And what you're trying to do is maximize as much profit as you possibly can out of this little tiny area that you've been given. And it's kind of like a SimCity in that there are early scenarios where you have like a much smaller grid to start with. And as you continue to succeed at those or fail at them, you will get a little bit of a currency you can use to like upgrade the size of the grid or add to the different kinds of tiles that you can place down. You can like start to research things. So it's a little bit like a run-based city builder, which I think is very cool. Like Dorf Romantik, I think, did a great job of that, but, you know, is very much trying to be like a lean back, chill experience, even though there is like a score at the end. And
yeah,
Mega Dystopia Micro Architect is very much trying to kind of be the opposite, where it's like, this is a little bit stressful. Like you are in a position where you need to maximize the score that you're getting. And that over time you can continue to unlock more things that will make achieving a higher score easier or harder for yourself. I imagine, you know, even though having more space on a grid seems like it would make things easier, you're also unlocking more tiles alongside that, and it's going to make the game more difficult.
Right. And more options, more choices. Yeah.
So it really feels to me like, and I think this is a good one to end on, because I think MDMA is this game that is asking the question, what would a city builder look like on a device like this? And I think all of the experiences I've had that are the best experiences on the Playdate so far are ones where a developer has asked questions like that. I think there are things like Mars After Midnight, which is like, this wouldn't exist anywhere except the Playdate. And I think that's very cool. But asking the question like, you know, what would a Pokemon look like on here? Or what would a city builder look like on here? And having it show up in this like really interesting kind of like nuanced quick hit way that makes use of the features of the device in like an interesting way is really great and really special. And I think that's the thing that really on the whole appeals to me about the Playdate is like Panic from the ground up designed the device to be really exciting and very cool and cute and fun and weird. But as soon as you put that into the hand of equally creative developers, you get things like all of the games that I just mentioned. So I don't know where they're going with the future of Playdate. As far as I can tell, I don't know if there's going to be a season two of games. It seems like they've just kind of moved into this catalog space where like you could just buy games individually. But I definitely am going to come back with more Playdate games because I only have two games from season one so far. So there's going to be a lot more. I know there are some from some developers who I really love coming down the pipeline eventually. Like I know there's a Zach Gage game in there. I'm really excited about that one. And I know there's some other stuff that I've heard is really great, but I need to like wait to get access to, which is kind of fun. And there are also some other games that I am intentionally not bringing up because they are games that actually do involve like putting more time into them. There's this one that I started playing, it's called Island, and it's an experience that takes a full hour. Like you need to sit down and play the Playdate for a full hour because there's no way to save the game, and that's apparently a very intentional design choice. So I haven't had a full hour to play the Playdate like in one sitting yet, at least outside of needing to check out like a billion games at once. But this is one that I'm really excited to check out and eventually bring back. And there are some other games that I've downloaded, like a game called Resonant Tale, which apparently is kind of like a Link's Awakening. I got another one called Initial Daydream, which is like a full ass RPG in the style of like a Dragon Quest. There's just a lot of stuff that I'm really excited to dip into that I just haven't had time to. So I will return with more Playdate talk eventually.
I'm looking forward to it. And honestly, I would love to pick up one because I think I would like this system for us to be something we bring up like routinely, not just like, here's the Playdate episode, like here's a Playdate game alongside X, Y, and Z.
I feel totally the same way. That's a little bit why I wanted to put off some of the games also, because this is the Playdate episode, but every episode can be a Playdate episode in its own way.
Exactly. Yeah, I would like to incorporate it in the actual fold of like, here are the new consoles.
Yeah.
Like, obviously it's a very distinct one, but I think I would like to see how it like organically enters the lineup for me.
Yeah.
And what games I'm playing.
Same. Yeah. It's just so fun to have and to hold and to use that I don't see a world in which I get bored of it anytime soon. And again, yeah, like I'm going to endeavor to just have it with me for the next like week or two and see what that feels like as like my pocket device that I'm bringing with me. So yeah, that's the Playdate. It's over at play.date if you want to pick one up. I don't know where they're at on like pre-orders and how long it takes to get one in your hands. I mean, very famously, I think 40,000 of them just got stolen off the back of a FedEx pallet recently.
Oh my God.
But the people at Panic were like, we know exactly where they are because they started registering all the devices in Las Vegas. So like they weren't very good at like hiding them because they all have serial numbers attached and stuff. So I don't know how that's like affecting shipping or whatever, but if you're interested in getting one, again, they're $200. I think that's the biggest thing for me is like, I do think $200 is a lot. Like it is.
Yeah.
It's pretty steep.
It's not that far off from getting a Switch, you know, which is like a notably different console.
Or, I mean, like any of the, you know, handheld device, like the Miu Mini that I was just talking about before. Like,
that's probably a better comparison. Yeah.
It's like $70, you know, it's like pretty cheap to get one of those. And it, you know, obviously plays thousands and thousands of different games. But
I guess the idea is you're saving on games. You know, you're not going to be spending as much money on games as you would like on the Switch or whatever.
Yeah, you're getting that first season of games for free, which I think is like super nice. And I didn't even talk about either of the first games that you get, but they're both very good. And use the crank in like really interesting and fun ways, as you would expect from the first two games that they give you. And that's why I'm so excited about the other ones. So yeah, again, $200, it's a little bit much. I understand if you, dear listener, are not interested in picking one of these up. But for me, this is just like, and for you, I imagine, this is just the kind of thing that I want to support. And again, like it just is the answer in a lot of ways to so many conversations you and I have had on the show for so many years that it just feels like such a slam dunk to like have one of these and to shout it out as often as possible. I didn't buy it with my own money. Again, I received it as a gift, which I think is notable, but I did buy so many games so quickly that our cart got declined because I wanted to support it.
Yeah, first time that's happened.
It's the first time that's happened. Yeah.
I was like, is Brennan all right? Anyway, very exciting. Thank you for sharing all that. I definitely want to catch up with this device and see which games work for me, but we will continue this conversation one way or another.
And look, when you get one, if you're like, man, I wish Solitaire was on here, or I wish Tetris was on here, or any of those things, like guess what, you can just get those things off itch. Like everyone has made the thing that you want.
Sorry, I just love the idea of getting a new console and being like, oh man, there's some Solitaire. Like, I know you specifically love Solitaire.
I do,
but
yeah.
I would never have that thought unless you just said it right now. Like, that is so funny.
I think for me, Tetris was the big one for me. There is one that that Chase talked about on Video Game Podtimism, which I have played, that's called Blockbuster. That's like a really great, really considered version of Tetris for the Playdate. It's not really Tetris, but like has a lot of Tetris ideas and uses the crank in fun ways. Like, it's a cool game, but I just kept thinking to myself, like, I do wish, like, this thing is Game Boy adjacent enough that I wish I just had Tetris on here also. And I found one. It's called Quandino. I'll shout it out. It's called Quandino. It's on itch. It's great.
Here's the real question. Has anyone ported Doom to this thing yet?
Yo,
has that happened?
Great question. I'm going to answer that for you in real time. I feel like the answer's got to be yes, right?
Yeah, I just feel like you got to continue the legacy of Doom being on everything.
Yes.
Yes. I wonder what the crank does.
It,
probably shoot, right?
It seems like it that's how you go forwards.
That rocks.
So yeah, you look around with the D-pad and you walk forward with the crank.
That might be, I need to play it and I'll report back if that's my favorite version of Doom. But that rocks.
Wow. Yeah, it's just called Play Doom.
What a world. A new console. I love this.
Isn't it great?
I'm curious to see if there are any, like, I'm sure there will be, like, other consoles like this. That are built around like specific design choices, you know.
Yeah.
Like, is there like a DS version of this? It's all about the touchscreen, for example,
right?
You know, like,
yeah,
bring that back. But I think starting with like kind of a, okay, what's like the most retro style of handheld, and what's a very almost steampunk gadget we can attach to this. Brilliant choice.
Yeah. I think, oh my God, I didn't even mention this, but like this thing also does have a microphone in it.
Oh, hell yeah. You can play Seaman on it.
You can play Seaman on it.
turn the heat up with the crank.
The back of it is magnetic, so you can also like put it on your fridge or something. And when you have it locked, it just becomes a clock, which is really nice. And the battery lasts forever.
Are all of them yellow or are there different colors?
Yeah, they're all yellow. Yeah, they're all this like very like warning sign yellow, which I actually really like.
yeah, it's nice.
They're apparently also working on a speaker dock for it that like charges it. So like magnetizes to this dock. And they're also apparently doing some kind of deal with Pool Suite FM, which is like a great website. You can just go listen to like great like kind of 70s funk music that has like a kind of beachy vibe. They're releasing an app for this. So you can just like listen to the radio, quote unquote, through the Playdate, which is cool. They're just like continuing to make cool stuff for this and releasing it. So I feel like, you know, shout out to the early adopters of this thing for like making it possible. Shout out to the developers who like released that first season of games and all the people who are making catalog games now. But I think like I would never want to push people into spending $200 on something that they don't want to. But I do think in this case, if you have been considering a Playdate and it does seem like something you want to support, now might actually be the best time with the whole first season available and this catalog and the itch stuff and the things that Panic are working on. In terms of like peripherals and updates and stuff, it seems like it's kind of like matured now, which is cool.
Yeah, it's an investment in their future.
Yeah,
if you're willing to make it or able to make it.
Didn't even mention this, but like Panic, great publisher. They I think the most famous game recently that they published was Untitled Goose Game. If you want like an idea of where they're coming from.
I had no idea that was them. That's so cool.
So that
totally tracks.
I should have probably said that at the top. That feels like, just take the vibe of Untitled Goose Game and put it in console and UI design, and you get the Playdate.
Crank to hunk, you know?
It's weird that there's not an Untitled Goose Game thing on the Playdate. I wonder if that's...
I could see like a very limited, like an 8-bit version of it. That could be fun.
Yeah.
Honestly, just a side scroller where you hunk instead of do anything else.
I would love that.
Anyway, why don't we wrap up?
Yeah.
Are you ready?
Yeah, now seems like a good time to wrap up. We'll have a big link in the show notes, obviously. I don't know if this stuff is on Backlogged. I should check. But if it is, I will put a backlog list together of all of these games and all the other ones I'm checking out. And you can check that out there.
And a backlog question. Can you, like, if there isn't a game on there, you can, like, request to upload it, right?
Yeah. So the thing about Backlogged is that it is pulling from a video game version of IMDb called IGDB. Believe it or not, Internet Game Database is what it stands for. So it's just pulling from the API on IGDB. So if there's not a game on Backlogged, that means it's not on IGDB. And you can just go create an account there and add a game manually, which I have done multiple times. Actually, Domino Drop, the game I brought up earlier, was not on IGDB when I first signed up for Backlogged, but it is one of my favorite games of all time. It's in my top five like shelf that's on your profile.
Oh yeah.
And I went and like made all the assets and found all the stuff and like made sure that whole profile was filled out so I could add it to my profile on Backlogged.
That rocks. That really is a top five game if you made it yourself, made the profile at least.
I felt obligated. Yeah.
I feel like the Backlog top five is like the most benign version of the MySpace top eight.
Yeah.
You know, like,
yeah,
I love it.
It's also like, you know, Letterboxd has that, but I feel like people are being put on blast for it's a top four on Letterboxd. I feel like people get put on blast for their top four on Letterboxd all the time because Letterboxd is like such a weird, like, film bro social network. And I feel like Backlog is like much nicer about it. It's like no one's ever commenting on what your top five is, but it does feel like such a wholesome and fun thing to put together regardless.
Totally. I also love, I might have said this before, but I adore the fact that on Backlog there are two types of reviews. Like on Letterboxd, if like all the reviews are like people trying to get their best joke, like,
yes,
you know, it's just like a competition of jokes. And on Backlog, the reviews are either like 12 pages of like, ever since the history of the medium began.
Yes.
Or just like, piss! And like, you know, 1,200 likes. Like they gave like Elden Ring half a star and wrote piss in all capitals. And it's like the most liked review. I adore it. I love that stuff. That's also my approach. Like I'll write out the like, ever since I began playing games. Or just like, buy Azura! You know, and then that's my most liked review.
Yeah. Pretty much all of my reviews on Backlogged right now are all like full ass essays, except for my review of Lost Odyssey, which is just like one paragraph about how disappointed I was.
You gotta get a piss review in there. Just like one word and an exclamation point. Do it. It's thrilling.
Man, I've been thinking about Lost Odyssey a lot recently. I feel like that's a game I will... That's a little bit of a white whale for me. Like, I'll go back and play that.
I bought it when you had your phase, and that was around the same time you fell off. So I have it. I have not played it yet. I think that would be a really fun conversation.
Yeah.
To have to... I mean, we've talked about it already, but I think it'd be fun to talk about together.
I think it is one of the most fascinating games narratively I've ever played. The reason I'm thinking about it a lot is because I've been watching Freer and the Wanderer, and also reading Freer and the Wanderer, just like an amazing anime and manga about a party of adventurers who defeated the big demon king, and the show and the story is about like what happens after, and it's followed.
Oh yeah, I started that. You like it?
Oh my god, it's amazing, Steven.
I watched the pilot and I liked it, but I wasn't fully gripped yet. But I also recognize I've only seen one episode.
You gotta keep going, because the whole thing is from the point of view of Freerin, who is the like elf in the party, and she is like basically immortal because she's an elf. And it's essentially about like years and years and years after she defeated the demon king, most of the other members of the party are like old and passing away and stuff, and she's just like kind of continuing to live her life and is questioning what being like pseudo immortal means and how time passes so quickly for humans in comparison, and like just feels so much like Lost Odyssey's same like thematic core.
I like that aspect of it a lot. I guess I just didn't, I think what I have to do is, now that Delicious in Dungeon is a hit anime and I'm nearing the end of the manga, I need to finish that first before I start a new series, I think.
Yeah, I get that. I will say that Freerin is really in the same conversation as Delicious in Dungeon. Like, those two shows are really, and manga are like really kind of rotating around the same spheres of people who like love the same stuff.
Yeah.
So I think if you like Delicious in Dungeon, you will grow to love Freerin also.
I'm sure I will. I like the art style a lot. I will say too, for those who started watching
It's hard to say. I actually like saying Dungeon Meshi, which is like the Japanese name. It's much easier to say.
It's so much easier to say. Yeah. Those who started watching Dungeon Meshi, I think it's great. Like, the anime is awesome so far. I've only seen the first few episodes, but because I've read the manga, I know where the story goes, and it seems to be a pretty one-to-one adaptation. I feel like I would recommend to those who have just started watching, definitely stick with it. Like, I think the first few episodes are really good and really funny. And like the manga, it's a very comedy first series for a while, but the story eventually kind of becomes like about desire and about like actual like appetite for food, but also like what these characters actually want, and if you can want something not at the cost of another. It's really cool. Like, I think it is, like, it does eventually become like almost as philosophical as Freerin sounds, but it takes a while to get there. So I just feel like the show might present itself as like a very just like pure comedy. And I do think this story really does pick up the further into it you get. So, but I like both. I like that they can, that's why I love the series, is it balances tone really well in that way. It's really good.
That's anime talk. Honestly, there is another anime that I've been meaning to bring to the show for like about 3 weeks and just keep not doing. And maybe I'll hold off on it still. I think we should wrap up, but there's another show. I'll just say the name. It's called Solo Leveling. If you've watched it, you know why I would want to bring it up on the show. We'll talk about it some other time.
Yeah, I would love to. Anyway, thank you so much for listening to this. As you know, Into the Cast at Online is our hub for everything. If you like the show, the best way to help it grow is to share it with a friend. You can also rate and review us on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. There was a recent Apple Podcast review that made me laugh in a good way. Thank you to the person who wrote that. They said, if hearing it really makes me consider how I understand time in a conversation about a video game clearly made for children, sounds like a good time. Definitely give this show a listen. Thank you to the person who wrote that. That really made my day.
That's very funny.
So if you also want to make me laugh with either a very thoughtful review or a really good joke, you can do that at Apple Podcasts and also help the show grow. We also have a Patreon. Links to the Patreon are into the cast at online. We currently have a lot of new ideas floating around for the Patreon, so we will announce those soon. If you are a patron, you may have received a survey about some ideas. We're filling out some options, seeing what people think. Thank you to those who have filled that out already. It might have already been sent out at the time of this episode. The Baldur's Gate 3 episode should already be out.
Oh my god, yeah.
It is one of our longest episodes ever. We finally see the I saw the edit from AJ. It is 5.5 hours long.
Oh my god.
Which is hilarious. I think our longest is still Goaty 23, which is 6.5. But that is one of our longer bonuses ever made.
Wow.
Thank you again to our friends Sadie and Kim for joining me in that gigantic quest. And of course, finally, off the bench, the hero himself, Nathan Drake in the Uncharted games will be our next bonus. And just a bit regarding scheduling bonuses, I think we've always communicated like when we have to shift, like, okay, they're monthly and now we're going to give them more time to do bigger episodes. And then we found that maybe planning them in advance was helpful. We kind of announced at the beginning of Game of the Year, like our lineup for the next 6 months. I think we're probably going to avoid doing that in the future just to give ourselves a little bit more flexibility and not kind of have that amount of time locked in. So we'll definitely always communicate like once we've decided what bonus is going to be for that month or that period of time. But I think once Uncharted comes out, we're going to shift to like more options for us, not kind of lock in things that ahead of time, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I think like one of the best examples of this ever is Ratchet and Clank Rift Apart, which was like a game that we did not plan on doing a bonus about, but just loved it so much that we just felt the need to like jump in and do that bonus as soon as we finish the game. And like we want the flexibility to be able to do that when games like that show up.
Yeah, I also think we are we announced that we were going to do a Tears of the Kingdom bonus, and I think we may either do that later in the future or might just have like a spoiler discussion.
Yeah, I think when you're done with it, I would definitely just I want to talk to you about the end of that game. That's really that was really the impetus for me wanting to do a bonus about it initially, but that doesn't need to be a whole bonus episode. That could just be a spoiler chat.
Totally. But yeah, I think we just gave ourselves maybe too many gigantic games and bonuses back to back in addition to our really ambitious D&D Patreon episode. So once all that's done, we're going to look at the clean slate and kind of go back to our usual schedule.
Yeah.
So again, we'll always keep you posted on where we're at, and we appreciate how understanding everyone is when we have to shift our schedule a little bit. We also are part of a network, TWG. We have a lot of other great shows in the network, like Frog of the Week, Video Game Podtimism, Can't Let It Go, and new shows potentially on the horizon. More on those soon. I don't know when I can spill the beans, but I'm very excited for those involved. And I think that's actually it for once. I don't think I forgot anything, did I?
No, I think that's everything. The only thing that I will add is that you do have the ability to add playdate games onto lists in Backlogged. So that list will be in the show notes. I just put it together.
Awesome. I will also say at Into the Casted Online, we have our merch store. Yes. There you can buy merch as well as personal messages and commercial ad reads for the show. We are planning on adding some more items to the merch store in the near future. We'll probably announce that and add those items around the same time as the GameCube premiere in July. So a bit more time before we shift things up in the merch store. There might also be some items that we no longer feature. If there are any items there that you want now, now is your time.
Yeah, I think we mentioned in the past that the like previous season logos, that was a 1 year thing. So that will be available, or those things will be available until the GameCube episode comes out. And then it'll just be like whatever the most current season art is. Cool.
We have more announcements too, but I'm going to wait until a bigger episode and closer to the beginning to share all that information. So for the 15% of you that have stuck around to the end, thank you very much. You get the real shit. You get the real info. You know what I mean?
Dude. You get here. Should I reward people?
Yes. We should always reward people for getting to the end of an episode, I think.
We'll do this one more time. Just like a great final bit.
Shadow Gadget!
Yes!
An encore from Shadow Gadget.
Do the thing! Do the thing again!
My name is Brendan Bigley. You can find me on the internet at Brendan Bigley.
I'm Stephen Hilger. You can find me at Stephen Hilger and Stephen Hilger Art. Have a wonderful rest of your day. Look out for ghosts and capture them on the subway.
PWG, the worst garbage, the online.